Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. Let's get on into it. Happy Sunday. It's kind of cloudy here. Not as cloudy as it was. It's starting to get a little bit more blue sky out there. It's my day of relaxation and my day to have extra time. I've been working a lot, doing like 6 days a week kind of stuff. But I had a little bit more time this week, and I'm gonna have a little bit more time next week with Thanksgiving coming up. And so I've just been sitting around and reading my books and thinking about stuff, and I've been vaporizing some Dali, which is headbanger by some collection of symbols cake. I'm guessing it's some sort of wedding cake variety. It's like a dollar sign, an at sign, percentage. Almost like a curse word, I guess. The unmentionable word. They call it mind-melting gas. I don't know if you have green dot wherever you are. It's expensive marijuana. And it's not something that I usually have access to because of its intense price. Like cannabis here in Colorado Springs is affordable. Usually you can get ounces for less than $90. But back when I was a kid, you'd spend most of the time like $30 on an eighth. And there's still parts of the country here in the United States where it could be like $60 an eighth if it's still illegal and hard to get hold of, supply and demand and all that. But I rarely spend more than $6 to $9 on an eighth nowadays. I guess I'm a little bit more than that, but fuck it. My math brain is not turned on. But it's every once in a while I have to retaliate against the stresses of finances. I've been trying to navigate the world of medical insurance in my country, and it's infuriating and stressful. And I'm so sick of thinking about it. Like, I plain do not want to think about it anymore at all. Like, I'm going to be spending so much money just to potentially get some money off in the future. It's so stupid, and like my head hurts with it, man. And so I have to retaliate every once in a while, and I guess for me this is like my fine bottle of wine. I know the quality probably doesn't differ enough, and there's not enough reasoning to validate spending so much more, but I think it's more of a mental thing just to say that I can. Say, fuck you, universe. I'm kidding. I love you, universe. But I'm going to go do something that I'm not supposed to do, I guess, by spending, 20 extra dollars. Woo! But it's the little things that you got to do in life to find some sense of peacefulness. And I've been enjoying this morning and just thinking about stuff. And so why am I here? What are we doing here? What's the point of all this? I first and foremost want to focus on this idea of love. And I was reading from P.D. Uspensky's book Tertium Organum, which I've discussed in a couple of the recent episodes here on the Gingerbread Man. But the chapter I was reading this morning was talking more about this idea of the world soul, and he even mentions Brahman and Mahadeva, which is the deity that's referenced in the Bhagavad Gita that I've also talked about on the show. So it's kind of exhilarating to see him using my analogies. And he talks about how this psychic existence, this idea of experience of having a life, I guess, like with life forms themselves being divvied up into a diverse stratification of being, but he goes even further to me than me by saying that even the cells in our bodies perchance have this conscious experience, the psychic life, which, I mean, I guess I've considered that, but for me, it's even hard to try to, I guess, try to convince people to think about a housefly having some sort of experience and some sort of life that is, comparable to my own or your own existence. You know, there's this anthropomorphic view where only the human perspective, the human vantage point from our, you know, the way we describe and perceive the world is the ultimate way to depict reality to everything. But everything might, every other thing might have a different vantage point, you know, and he even goes down to the molecules and the atoms and, you know, and the classic reference to how the solar system might be the nervous system of some galactic being. And all these kind of things makes my skin turn on end. But that's kind of this connection between, like, because we're having this experience right here, but at the same time, our cells might be having this little microcosm of experience too. You know, and all these things are simultaneous. And in past discussions of love, I've talked about the interconnection between all things and this sort of metaphysical glue that entangles all of the individuals in reality into some sort of totality, into the universe itself. And that sort of glue, that tug between everything, you know, in a long-winded way, that's kind of how I see what love is. And it's not just romantic, ooey-gooey, Valentine's Day kind of stuff here. You know, it's far more abstract and far bigger the way I see it. And I think it's very important. And I find that it motivates me. It makes it so that I can, you know, want to inquire into other things' vantage points and other people's vantage points and giving the time of day to a differing opinion. I find it's very important in our society more so than ever, you know. And then with that, I also feel that creativity is an incredibly important concept, you know, and it's the free will part of all of our choices. It's our ability to choose at any moment some set of circumstances. We can choose how we want to live. We can choose how we want to be, and we can paint our lives in many different colors and shades and hues. And every single of these individual vantage points that we were just discussing can all live creatively in tangent and together. And that's kind of how this world soul takes a step forward. You know, we can grow up as a universe, perhaps, and maybe we're just all stuck on this small level right now, dealing with our own little systems. And maybe in the schoolyard of life, in the schoolyard of existence, that's the first class, is to learn our own place, and then we move on forward, you know, and towards changing the rest of the world and then the universe. I don't know. It gets big, and it definitely feels like fantasy sometimes and like storytelling, but I know it's not too. You know, behind all the fancy words, it's simply just living. It's simply just watching our words. It's watching our conversations, looking at the similarities between our fellow humans foremost, but then we can look at the similarities between us and our pet cat. You know, like, the unspoken communication between me and my cat is intense. There's a lot of really cool things to analyze even there, you know, and that's not even a human, you know. But P.D. Uspensky would even argue that we can analyze the conscious experience of an inanimate being like a rock, which further goes into all that kind of spiritual hoodoo-y kind of stuff. But anyways, I digress. That's why I'm here. Those two main points that I hammer down at the beginning of every show. I know it might kind of get redundant. There's similarities between all the cliff notes there, and I rambled on a little bit longer than I usually do. But that's what I consider to be two vantage points, is looking at connection and then being curious. I think that's invaluable. And so one of the other books I was reading today was this new book on lucid dreaming by this sleep researcher named Stephen LeBurge. And He's fantastic. I love his prose. His way of writing is compelling. And I, as you probably know, if you've been a long-term listener, am obsessed with this dream world, with what other type of consciousness that space is. Because to me, it seems obvious that it's very, very different than what I have access to right now, my waking consciousness here. And memory seems to be stored in separate places because for most of my life, I had absolutely no access to any sort of memory, or at least I'm going to get into it later. I wasn't forming memories because I wasn't paying attention. And what LaBerge gets into with these concepts of dreaming is how much impact expectation has on how we dream and when and what we dream. Of course, the material of the dream world is very personal. It's created from our psyche. It's also created from the not persona. It is created from these shadow aspects of who we are. In fact, a lot of these dream worlds seem to be heavily funded primarily by unconscious material. And that in itself can be reason enough to ignore it, especially if the material that we have to come in contact with is distressing or scary. But what this book in particular on is the key word is lucidity. And this is something that I'm coming to realize that I really did not, still do not, maybe tiny glimpses of lucidity that I've had. And I'll give examples later, but there is a world of difference between what LaBerge would define as dream recall and lucid dreaming. And so, what I've been fascinated by and excited by in the last few months to maybe recent years, as I've grown my creative muscles in myself and have learned how to be more right-brained and more responsive to the associations of thinking. You know, when I was younger, I was very logical and very left-brained and very clerical, and like I did not even take part in any sort of art classes. I didn't like these acts of expression. I didn't like interacting outside of the rote memorization of facts, and I was really good at it. I liked reading, I liked escaping into fiction and creating alternate worlds, but I wasn't really determined to try to express myself creatively. And the artistic side of humanity is very important. And the more I started to focus on that in my early 20s, I started to get more sensitive. And with that came dreams. That was one of the things I noticed probably 6 to 7 years ago when I started changing my brain, was that I started to dream more. And the more and more loose I get, the easier it is for me to do that. And a big part of that, of course, was psychedelia and learning how to be comfortable with intense compounds like dimethyltryptamine. But the big picture with recalling dreams is it's a slippery bar of soap. You know, like last night, for instance, I know that I dreamed. We all dream. You know, the fact that we don't remember them depends on if we were paying attention. I really believe that. And like when I wake up, which I do so often, I can feel the resonance of this other place. But what happens is that within that half a second, that microsecond of coming into consciousness, of coming into this space, because it's somehow so much more real, somehow, we sort of amalgamate ourselves. We gather all the loose bits and we make ourselves. We're reborn in that moment into this from what was that. And all too often, I think I am so identified with either this dream world or with what's going on now, because right now I'm fully identified. That's why I'm able to say these words. But when I'm dreaming, I'm also fully identified with that, but I'm not storing any sort of memory information. And so it's almost like these two worlds are parallel to each other with this thin glass thing keeping them separate. And if I can somehow slip in that half a second when I'm waking up and think about the dream, I can almost pull it into this reality, and I can almost kind of like rewrite the coded memory of what, because of course, now that I'm recalling it, even in that moment, because now I'm in waking space, I'm awake, and now I'm recalling the dream, you know. So now everything that I am sensing about it is in memory. Does that make sense? That this is the important part that I found compelling from this book. Very, 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 very rarely have I ever been lucid in the dream and thought that it wasn't real and considered it not a dream. I'm always so committed, and that's what's always made me feel really weird about this whole situation, is especially when you have distressing dreams and dreams that are difficult. It can be almost a relief and like a thank God moment, and it's really easy to push it away and say, oh, I'm just glad none of that was real, you know. And so what I find so interesting is that people have this capacity to do this thing where they can notice themselves in the dream, and they can become aware of the fact that they are dreaming. That's what the definition of lucid dreaming is. That's the lucidity. That's something that I do not have. I only have one example that I can think of, and it was brought into my memory, which is where I recalled it, was yet again in memory, because by the time I'd woken up, I'd already become ignorant and forgot that I'd even, I think, been lucid in that moment. But one of these things that people have commonly is issues with luminosity, with turning down the light levels in their dreams, and he calls it the light switch phenomena, where someone will go up and try to shut the light off and it won't shut off. And so you end up switching the light switch on and off and the light just stays the same. And then you're like, oh, that's fucking weird. And I had a dream a couple months ago where me and Odin were moving into this like apartment building, but it was like massive, like this gigantic skyscraper. And then the apartments were hanging from individual units from like bars that were stretching out like cranes, and then these apartments would be in like these glass units that were like hanging. I don't know if I'm describing it well. It was bizarre. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And like when me and Odin moved in, the person in the weird office, we were having like an interview, and it was asking me where I'd like to live, and I didn't want to deal with all what seemed like really difficult getting around. And so I was like, I would rather live on the first floor. And then, because my apartment was right next to the front door, and all the walls were made of glass for some reason, and they all had these curtains, these elaborate curtain systems, so you could curtain off all the walls so people couldn't see into your apartment. And I remember just being really distressed because I could never get them all closed in time, and I always felt like I was being watched. And at some point, I remember going through this elaborate maze that was this apartment, and it was so large with stairs, and it was just very weird. I remember trying to like turn the lights off and or turn them on in one place, because when I leave a room, I try to turn all the lights off. And I remember jiggling the light switch because I couldn't get all the lights off in the apartment, and being super like worried that like I'd get in trouble for leaving the lights on because there was glass windows and people could see inside. And so like I remember like locking up and leaving and just being really anxious about it. But I think at some moment in all that weirdness, because I left the apartment and woke up and came into waking space, and then I fell asleep and went back into this world. I think that at some point I realized that a lot of it was fake, and then I remember walking around a lot calmer and not as distressed, because there was a large portion of the dream where I completely identified with it, and this was now real, you know. And so when it's real, you're not lucid, and it's it's when you realize that none of this is at least it's less real than what we define this right now, you know, and that is kind of the doorway for lucidity, and that's when somebody can wake up in the dream. And I think that's when I got more calm, and I think that's why I have a lot more memories, because I think at some point I was walking around and just looking at shit, and it was just like really weird. I remember there was like a cupboard where each drawer had different sizes of nuts and bolts. Like, you know, and I think at some point in those time periods I was actively looking around because I thought it was strange, and I think I was becoming more lucid, you know. And I find it just very, very cool. I want to be able to do this more. I ordered a book. I didn't dream up a book, but I ordered a book by this lady named Patricia Garfield, who's kind of a wackadoodle, but she wrote a book called Creative Dreaming, which is more goal-oriented, where it's trying to give you things to challenge yourself to get better at it, because there's this theory that you can learn how to lucid dream and get better at it. And when I read that, I got super excited. It just seems like this playground that we all have at our disposal. I think he said at one point, he's like, almost half of your life you're asleep. What if you could reclaim all those hours that you're unconscious and turn them into memories, into experience? Like, lucidity literally unlocks half of our lives to us. And I see so many parallels yet again with psychedelia. With DMT, there's been time periods where I've completely lost myself, like the opposite of lucidity. There's also been times where I've lost myself and also been very lucid. Those are some of the most terrifying moments. But I've had some experiences where, because it's such a short-lived drug, the intensity and the cool part is probably less than 3 minutes. And then within 10 minutes of inhaling this noxious smoke, you are almost completely sober, if not more clear than before you started. And it's such a short window, which makes it so great for analysis if you have something that you can point your microscope at. And some of the experiences that I've had with it, I would inhale and go to this elaborate abstract space that I can't even remember because I wasn't watching. And then it's like, or I was watching, and I remember sometimes just being completely gleeful and fascinated. And then as I start to sober up, it's like you're on these lines being pulled up from below, and you're being risen back into the world. You know, you're being raised up on this like elevator sort of thing. And as you get raised up, all your memories start to amalgamate back onto you and attach. It's very similar to this waking process that we all do every morning. And it's like, I remember one time watching, you know, oh, that's what I did this morning. Oh, my name's Brandon. Oh, I that's what I look like. This is what I do. Oh, this is my world. And I remember one time even just like questioning. I was like, oh God, I hope that I get into the right one, was this weird thought I had, you know, like not on purpose, not silly. Like that was like a real feeling. I was like, oh God, I hope I get into my body. But of course, we have sticky lines that connect us to these egos. It's really hard to lose them. But there's so much similarities between this amalgamation. I keep saying that word, but it's like we precipitate into this ego. And the in-between space between that and not that is compelling. And it makes me not want to throw the baby in the bathwater out and consider these moments of unconscious sleep as no less real and effective than what we can watch, you know, because lucidity is bringing our egos into that space, right? And so maybe the loss of ego and the experience that happens there, even if we do not remember it, has an impact. One of the things that LaBerge talks about in his book is that, you know, the cool thing about a lot of these physiological tests and experiments that we have hundreds of them now done in dream studies and sleep studies, of which I would love to participate, is that time is similar in dreams. They found that in lucid dreaming, that the way time lapses is very similar. You know, you can have, it can be cut like a movie where, you know, there's one second you're in one room and the next second you're halfway across the world, and the brain will connect that as a lot of time has passed. But active watching, you know, like if somebody's woken up 5 minutes into a REM cycle, they'll usually describe 5 minutes of material. And if somebody's woken up 15 minutes into a REM cycle, they usually describe longer, but up to about 15 minutes of material. So it's like there's a similarity between the dream space and the outside that is being mirrored in the brain, because our minds and our bodies and even the equivalent spirit, all of this is part of some unit. It's all one thing. It's not multiple splits. The division does not exist. So if we perhaps embark upon some drama or go through a nightmare, we go through some stressful experience, if we're able to work through stuff in sleep that has physiological effects on the brain as if it was actually happening. This idea of reality, when we're fully committed to something, even in a dream, if we consider it to be real, this has an effect on us emotionally and physically. Even if we don't have access to the memories lucidly, it all matters. You know, like our dream worlds matter, the things. And so that's part of why I find it so compelling, is if I can start to interact with my unconscious, if I can be more lucid and ask questions to my subconscious, I think that this will be a doorway for me to become more enlightened to understand. And it seems very important to me. I'm very passionate about it. And so one of the things I would love to do, if I could use this show as an outlet, is to hear about your dreams. I would love to just have access to your reports. If you lucid dream, what does it feel like to be lucid? How do you do that? Do you have strategies? Do you do it on purpose? How do you lead yourself there? I would love to have access to stories. I love reading reports about people's dreams. And so if you would like to send me any material, and if you would want them to be shared, if you have a really cool dream, maybe I'll even share it on the show. I think that would be really, really, really cool. So just please email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com, and that'd be fantastic. I think that'd be a wonderful little crowd project to do if we could do it together. All right, I'm gonna go grab a book and we'll do a little bit of quotes, and then we'll see if Odin wants to sign you off, and then that'll be it for the week. So thank you so much for listening to me ramble. This is very important to me. I love trying to give something to be a relatable material. I like to build bridges between minds. And if any of this is compelling to you, go talk to somebody about it or go study it in your own world. So, yeah, I'll be right back. So today I'm going to be reading from a collection of Rumi's poems that I've been reading. It was translated by Coleman Barks, who I don't know a lot about. But I guess there's a lot of material by Rumi, and this is just some of it. Some of it's more religious. This is more secular. It was meant to be more relatable to anybody approaching it. Here goes. This is called One Song. What is praised is one. So the praise is one too. Many jugs being poured into a huge basin. All religions, all this singing, one song. The difference are just illusion and vanity. Sunlight looks slightly different on this wall than it does on that wall, and a lot different on this other one, but it is still one light. We have borrowed these clothes, these time and space personalities, from a light, and when we praise, we pour them back in. This one is called A Cross-Eyed Student. There are those who accept the law of Moses and not the grace and love of Jesus, like the Jewish king who killed Christians. This is not seeing right. Moses is inside the soul of Jesus as Jesus is the soul of Moses. One era belonged to one, then it was the other's turn, but they are one being. A teacher said to a slightly cross-eyed student, "Hand me the glass bottle there." "Which one?" "There are not two." "Don't scold me, teacher, but I see two." "Smash one of them." Of course, both were broken. This is how it is when we see through the double vision of lust, anger, or some religious self-interest.
A bribed judge cannot distinguish the one who's been cruel from the victim. A good prayer is, Lord, help us see both worlds as one. Last one. Four words for what we want. A man gives one coin to be spent among four people. The Persian says, I want anga. The Arab says, inab, you rascal. The Turk, uzum. The Greek, shut up all of you, we will have istafil. They begin pushing each other, then hitting with fists. No stopping it. If a many-languaged master had been there, he could have made peace and told them, I can give each of you the grapes you want with this one coin. Trust me, keep quiet, and you four enemies will agree. I also know a silent inner meaning that makes of your four words one wine. Yeah. So Rumi was a Sufi mystic living, you know, throughout the Mediterranean. He was born in Afghanistan, but I think he also spent time in Spain. And it has a depth to it. It reminds me of the Tao, and maybe it's just because it's poetry, not the very flavorful kind of poetry, but I still see so much depth to it. So thank you for letting me share that. I appreciate you giving me your time and your ears. And let me go grab O, and we'll sign you out.
Hello, it's Osco and the Gingerbread Man.
Woo! How are you?
How are you?
I don't know. I'm fine.
How are you guys doing? Mm-hmm. I bet you guys are doing good or bad. Well? I don't really have anything to say.
What's the coolest thing that happened this week?
Nothing, really.
Nothing cool happened?
Yes.
Zero?
I'm sorry.
You couldn't find one cool thing?
Yes.
Search your brain. Give me one cool thing that happened.
Nothing.
Well, that's boring. Well, okay. Nothing happened. That's fine too.
I'm sorry, guys.
Nothing to be apologized for.
Goodbye.
We appreciate you. Bye.